Hi, I'm Beth Gibbs, and every week at this time, Chris takes a look at the current issues of For Your Health. Our first article is titled, A Trick to Reduce Stress? Spend 20 seconds a day doing this easy practice by Deborah Netburn for the Tribune News Service. Eli Sussman was a fairly experienced meditator when he attended a month-long retreat at Plum Village, a Buddhist monastery in southern France, in 2017. The UC Berkeley PhD candidate in clinical science had been on other retreats where participants spent most of their time meditating. So he was surprised when he saw that the daily Plum Village retreat schedule included only 30 minutes of formal seated meditation a day. Midway through the retreat, he decided to extend one of his sessions, sitting beneath a tree for 3 hours. Later, he ran into a monk named Brother Treasure and told him about his practice. The monk's response was not what he expected. 3 hours? Sussman remembers Brother Treasure telling him with a smile. How about 3 breaths? That's all it takes to step into the present moment. The word stuck with Sussman. It led him to wonder whether an abbreviated practice that takes no more than a few breaths can make a difference in someone's life. 7 years later, he and his colleagues at Berkeley's Golden Bear Sleep and Mood Research Clinic have evidence that it might. Earlier this year, they published a paper online in the journal Behavior Research and Therapy that describes how a simple 20-second self-compassion micro-practice lowered stress levels and improved the mental health of undergraduate volunteers who did it every day for a month. Quote, two of the biggest barriers people have for developing a meditation habit is having the time to do it and developing the habit of doing it regularly, said Sussman. Micro-practices are like tiny training sessions that are based on the most potent parts of therapeutic practices. Sussman then described the practice that he developed for the study and explained how anyone can use it to try to feel better in less than 1 minute a day. Quote, the instructions we gave were to close your eyes and call to mind something about yourself that has been bothering you and making you feel unworthy, unloved, or not enough, and notice what arises in the body. Then we asked people to send kindness and warmth to themselves by placing one hand over the heart and another over the belly with the energy of giving themselves a big hug and notice what arises in the body now. Next, we invited them to ask themselves, how can I be a friend to myself in this moment? Finally, we told them to open their eyes when they were ready. And doing this for 20 seconds a day really made a difference in the lives of the study participants, the reporter asked. Yes, but it only worked for people who practiced it regularly. In our study, we looked at the subset of people who practice daily and at the whole sample of people who were given the instruction. More frequent practice was associated with greater increase in self-compassion and a greater reduction in stress and mental health problems, like symptoms of depression or anxiety, compared to a control group. Well, what are some of the ways that people can send kindness and warmth to themselves? The key phrase we used in the study was, how can I be a friend to myself in this moment? What we meant by that is imagine you were seeing a friend or your younger self in a similar situation, and you were being really caring to that friend. What would you tell them to do? How would you ask them to be? You can also imagine yourself receiving unconditional love from someone like a mentor, a parent, or a close friend. How would they relate to you in this moment of suffering? Is there a way you can give that same compassion to yourself? Well, does it matter where people do this practice? We didn't look at that, but that's a great question. Why is it helpful for people to touch their stomach and chest while doing the exercise? There has been so much work on touch and how beneficial it can be for people to receive touch, but it had not been looked at as a standalone intervention for emotional well-being in terms of people offering self-compassionate touch to themselves. I was interested in the synergy between thinking self-compassionate thoughts and doing this embodied form of self-compassionate touch. It offers two potential ways of regulating yourself. I should also say that we told participants they could choose other forms of touch, like stroking yourself on the cheeks or giving yourself a hug. What's most important is that the method of touch supports you in feeling compassionately toward yourself. I was surprised that the majority of students who participated in the study said they were too busy to do this 20-second practice every day. What's that about? Well, I was just joking with a friend about this, and she said that when people are stressed, they can get wrapped up in feeling like they can't take 20 seconds to pause. It might be more a mindset than a reality, but there is more work to be done on how to help people feel like those 20 seconds are going to make a difference in their lives. We wash our hands for 20 seconds. We brush our teeth for 2 minutes. Why not take 20 seconds to do this? Do you have any advice on how people can make this practice a habit? Well, it can be helpful to choose a cue. You can practice after morning coffee in the living room, or whenever you're feeling stressed, if you can get yourself to do it then. The more specific you are in describing your cue and developing your plan, the more likely you are to develop the practice into a habit. Well, does this research suggest that there is no reason to do a longer practice? Well, most of the participants in our study were novice meditators or people who had never meditated before, so we don't know how this would look with people who have a really dedicated meditation practice or are very experienced with meditation. Rigorous research is needed for whether shorter practices have advantages over longer practices and for whom those advantages may be most pronounced. Also, just like brushing teeth is not a replacement for going to the dentist, this micropractice should not be a replacement for therapy or more intensive mental health care. The next article is titled, Experts Say Medicaid Rebate Change is Behind Inhaler Price Cuts, by Laura Klassen, Tribune News Service. A recent tweak to a Medicaid formula could be behind the shakeup to inhaler products, a series of changes that have both benefited and harmed patients with asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. Three of the four major inhaler manufacturers have announced plans to cap patient copays for all their inhalers at $35 a month in recent weeks, in addition to lowering the list prices of some of those products. But one drug maker also withdrew two popular children's inhalers from the market, and the alternative is in short supply. Boehringer Ingelheim, AstraZeneca PLC, and GlaxoSmithKline, also known as GSK PLC, all announced the $35 monthly copay cap, which could significantly extend the impact of their current patient assistance programs. The companies have simultaneously cut list prices. That's the initial price before health plans negotiate discounts and rebates for some, but not all, of their inhalers. The drug companies say they've made the changes because they're committed to helping patients. Some Democrats on Capitol Hill say it happened because of public pressure. But some drug pricing experts are pointing to a recent change in the formula of Medicaid's mandatory drug rebate program as the reason. It's the same reason experts pointed to when insulin manufacturers lowered their list prices, although those reductions were more widespread. The rebate change can force drug makers to actually pay Medicaid in some cases if list prices on older products outpace inflation. The effect is less severe on asthma products than it was on insulin, thanks to a 2009 ban on a common propellant found in old inhalers. That resulted in a wave of new inhalers with new patents. Because the change to the Medicaid rebate formula penalizes older drugs with higher prices the most, the newer inhalers are less affected than older insulin products. Quote, "They're still playing the same game," said Anna Kaltenbeck, a former Senate Finance Committee staffer under Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, who now leads ATI Advisory's prescription drug reimbursement practice. "It just brought the ceiling on the game down a little bit, and they're sort of diffusing it vis-a-vis the patients by giving them these copay coupons." The rebate change is tied to the change in list prices, though, not copays. Copay caps are important because they limit what patients pay, including, at least in this case, uninsured patients. But reducing list prices helps cut behind-the-scenes costs that are absorbed by the healthcare system. The rebate change took effect in January. GlaxoSmithKline in January reduced the list price for its Advair Diskus and Advair HFA inhalers, while AstraZeneca also reduced the list price of Symbicort. Boehringer Ingelheim is also planning to cut the list prices for Spiriva Handihaler and Atrovent HFA. Other factors, like Medicare's new penalty for raising prices faster than inflation, could also be driving the changes. Inhalers are prime examples, like insulin, of products where manufacturers have raised list prices over very long periods of time, said Will Feldman, a pulmonary doctor with Brigham and Women's Hospital and an instructor at Harvard Medical School. He pointed to Boehringer Ingelheim's decision to drop list prices on Spiriva Handihaler, an older inhaler that now faces generic competition, and not its newer product, Spiriva Respimat. That product is far less likely to be impacted by the Medicaid rebate cap policy change than Spiriva Handihaler, he said. Both Boehringer Ingelheim and AstraZeneca refuted the idea that the Medicaid rebate was behind the decision to cut list prices. Quote, "We continually look at market dynamics to assess what more we can do to address barriers to access and affordability of our medicines to help patients living with respiratory diseases lead healthier lives," said an AstraZeneca spokesperson. Not all the developments were positive for patients. GlaxoSmithKline in January also discontinued Flovent HFA and Flovent Diskus, two of the new inhalers approved for children. Insurance coverage for the authorized generics can vary, and the only other major alternative, Organon's Asmenex, is now in shortage because of an increased demand. Quote, "It's the perfect storm of what is wrong with our pharmaceutical system," said Feldman. "And the end result is patients in some cases are suffering and not getting the products they need." GlaxoSmithKline did not say whether the rebate was the driving factor behind its pricing changes or the decision to discontinue the two inhalers, saying it had been planning to discontinue the branded products for some time. Quote, "The price reductions build on our strong track record of increasing access and improving the affordability of its medicines, including an ongoing commitment to reasonable pricing," said a company spokesperson. Capping patient copays could greatly increase access to consumers as well, even though the drug makers already offer patient assistance programs. Kaltenbeck pointed to the ongoing access issues for insulin, despite the insulin makers' long-standing assistance programs. Quote, "We know that people were dying because they weren't getting insulin," she said, "which suggests to me that copay coupons and patient assistance programs aren't reaching people to the extent that you want them to be reached. Public pressure. Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Chairman Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, singled out the four major manufacturers in January as part of an investigation into inhaler prices. Recently, he took a victory lap in the wake of the drug makers' announcements to cap copays, saying, quote, "They're beginning to catch on to the fact that the American people are sick and tired of paying astronomical prices for the prescription drugs they need to stay alive." He acknowledged that the companies are only lowering list prices on some products, but stressed the importance of the copay caps to patients. He also attributed the drug companies' announcements to the committee's investigation and public backlash, rather than Medicaid's rebate program. Quote, "In this instance, we think it's public pressure," he said. Additionally, Sanders urged the last of the four major manufacturers that hasn't capped copays, Teva Pharmaceutical Industries Limited, to follow suit. The company is smaller and more focused on generics, he said, but he hoped Teva executives would come around. "They are considering it," he said. Teva did not respond to requests for comment. In November, the Federal Trade Commission warned a number of drug makers, including Teva and the other major inhaler manufacturers, that they had improperly listed patents in the Food and Drug Administration's registry, known as the Orange Book, which can help block competition from generic rivals. Teva was one of the several companies that refused to pull any of the patents the FTC challenged. Recently, the FTC took another step against the manufacturer, filing an amicus brief in a patent infringement suit Teva brought against Amneal Pharmaceuticals Incorporated for attempting to bring a generic version of its ProAir HFA to market. The FTC argues the patents that Teva is claiming are improperly listed. These issues underscore the broader dynamics that lawmakers and regulators still face in unwinding the tangled drug pricing system. "The copay caps are good for patients," said Feldman, "but it's not nearly enough." Quote, "It's a Band-Aid on a problematic drug pricing system in our country," he said. The next article is titled, "Colorectal Cancer is Rising Among Younger Adults. Some States Want to Boost Awareness," by Tim Henderson. Responding to new research on the rising incidence of colorectal cancer among younger adults, some states are trying to boost public awareness of the deadly disease, with a focus on Black and rural residents. In 2021, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force changed the routine screening age for colorectal cancer to 45 from 50, based on growing cases among younger adults. But many people, even younger, are finding themselves with life-threatening advanced cancer that could have been prevented with earlier detection. It's unclear why new generations are increasingly susceptible. Black and rural Americans are more likely to die from colorectal cancer at any age because they're less likely to get screening in time to save their lives. Using state and federal money, healthcare groups in Colorado, Delaware, Michigan, Mississippi, North Carolina, Texas, Washington State, and West Virginia have had some success in boosting screening rates. In Michigan, for example, healthcare groups last year surveyed Detroit area Black residents 40 and over and found that many mistakenly thought they didn't need colorectal cancer screenings if they didn't have any symptoms. The groups increased the screening rate by giving more information to patients and rolling out software to automatically alert providers to schedule screenings. West Virginia is considering a state version of a national program to raise more awareness among younger adults and their doctors, partly by bringing in trusted messengers in different communities to help spread the word, said Susan Eason, program director of the West Virginia Program to Increase Colorectal Cancer Screening. It's one of 35 state-level programs supported by federal, state, and local money, she said. With this on the rise, younger people need to be aware of symptoms, and providers also need to be aware. So when a patient presents with something like blood in the stool, they don't dismiss it as hemorrhoids, said Eason. Rural West Virginia residents face numerous barriers to screenings, including long distances on mountain roads to see doctors and a shortage of gastroenterologists and screening clinics that can mean a 6 to 9 month wait for an appointment. In addition, many residents have jobs that don't allow paid time off for seeking medical help. To help fill the gap, said Eason, her program is increasing access to chemical tests that can be done at home and sent by mail. However, an in-person colonoscopy is preferable because it can detect precancerous growths that doctors can remove. Two authors of a December report found that colorectal cancer is increasing with each generation and told Stateline that lowering the age for recommended screenings is less important than making sure that people actually get them. Quote, rather than lowering the age to initiate screening, I'd like to see us double down on our efforts to optimize screening participation, said Caitlin Murphy, an associate professor at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. More than 1 in 3 adults 45 or older has not been screened, according to the American Cancer Society. The study's lead author, Samir Gupta, a gastroenterologist and professor at the University of San Diego, agreed. Gupta said people under 45 should consider a colonoscopy if they have a family history or red flag symptoms such as rectal bleeding, bloody stools, unexplained weight loss, and low iron anemia. Young survivors who spoke to Stateline said they initially ignored the symptoms or that the symptoms were misinterpreted by medical professionals who did not expect cancer in such young patients. Jamila Mahmoud, a nonprofit worker in Milwaukee, said she was misdiagnosed 4 times before a CAT scan showed a massive tumor blocking her colon in 2019 at the age of 33, with stage 3 cancer that had spread to her lymph nodes. She had complained of increasingly sharp abdominal pain for months, but was told only to avoid spicy foods and take antacids. Now cancer-free after surgery and 8 rounds of chemotherapy, Mahmoud, who is 37 and engaged to be married, said she tells people not to let doctors take their symptoms lightly. Quote, I always tell people, if you feel like someone's not listening to you, go somewhere else, because you're precious. You only have one life, she said. Rates of colorectal cancer deaths have been slowly decreasing for all ages since 1968. When they were around 28 per 100,000, to around 13 in 2023. However, deaths of patients 45 and younger as a share of colorectal cancer deaths have grown from 2.5% in 1976 to 3.8% in 2023. It's according to a Stateline analysis of federal mortality data kept by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. From 2018 to early 2024, colorectal cancer death rates for all ages and for those under 45 have been highest in West Virginia and Mississippi, consistent with research showing that rural residents have a greater chance of dying from colorectal cancer. Kentucky, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Maine, Tennessee, and Vermont also had high rates for all ages and for younger people. The lowest rates were in Connecticut, Massachusetts, Utah, Colorado, and New York State. Rural areas have the highest rates of colorectal cancer deaths, according to the Stateline analysis. Rates are 42% higher for the most rural areas compared with the most urban areas. In his mid-20s and living in rural North Carolina without health insurance, Jacob J.J. Singleton didn't think about cancer at all when he had painful bowel movements leading up to his 2015 diagnosis of stage 4 cancer that had spread to his liver and lungs. Quote, "In my 20s, you know, I just thought I was invincible," said Singleton. "I told myself it was a pulled muscle because I was doing CrossFit training." Eventually, his parents prevailed on him to see a doctor when he could feel a pulsating mass in his abdomen that turned out to be a tumor. Later testing revealed that Singleton had a genetic disorder called Lynch syndrome that put him at increasingly high risk for fast-growing colorectal cancer. But he didn't know or suspect that at the time. Quote, "There's not a lot of medical history in my family," Singleton said. "In my family, guys don't go to the doctor much. You get through and don't complain. If you get sick, you just hope it gets better. It's like it's God will is the way they think of it." But even in big cities where residents have easier access to health care, it's possible for early symptoms to get overlooked. David Thau, a political fundraiser in Washington, D.C., was diagnosed at 34 in 2019 with a cancerous tumor that had broken through the walls of his colon. Quote, "If there had been some kind of awareness campaign, some kind of posters in my doctor's office, or other places where a 30-year-old could look and see, these are symptoms of colon cancer, I would have gotten this checked out much sooner," said Thau. And the next article is titled, "Telehealth Sites Promise Cure for Male Menopause Despite FDA Ban on Off-Label Ads," by Michael Scaturo. Online stores sprang up during the COVID-19 pandemic's telehealth boom, touting testosterone as a cure-all for men's age-related diseases, despite FDA rules issued years ago restricting such low testosterone advertising. In ads on Google, Facebook, and elsewhere, testosterone telemedicine websites may promise a quick fix for sluggishness and low libido in men. But evidence for that is lacking, said physicians. And the midlife malaise for which testosterone is being touted as a solution is more likely caused by chronic medical conditions such as poor diet or a sedentary lifestyle. In fact, doctors urge caution, and the FDA recommends that all testosterone supplements carry a warning that they may increase the risk of heart attack and stroke. Now, valid medical reasons do exist for treating some men with testosterone. The hormone as a medication has existed for decades, and today's patients include men with hypogonadism, some transgender men who use it to help transition physically, and sometimes women dealing with menopausal symptoms. It has also been used for decades by bodybuilders and athletes to enhance strength. However, online dispensaries can overplay the idea of what is sometimes called male menopause or even manopause to drive sales of highly profitable testosterone-boosting injectables, often ignoring safety guidelines that should prevent healthy men from using the hormone. And some of the websites target military veterans. Quote, "I have seen ads online that do cross the line," said Stephen Nissen, a physician and the chief academic officer for the Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. Quote, "For mood and low energy, prescribing testosterone provides little to no benefit. They are promoting testosterone for indications that are not on the label. And those who use it also risk having to take testosterone medication indefinitely because testosterone replacement therapy can cause the body to cease its own production of the hormone. And that's all the time we have for in this week's look at For Your Health. If you have any questions about this or other programs on Chris Radio, call the Chris Listener line at 860-727-9579. That's 860 727-9579. I'm Beth Gibbs. So long until next time.
This is Barbara Foster with Diabetes Update. Does the risk of stroke from common risk factors change as people age? Source is American Academy of Neurology. High blood pressure and diabetes are known risk factors for stroke, but now a new study shows that the amount of risk may decrease as people age. The study is published in an online issue of Neurology, the medical journal of the American Academy of Neurology. High blood pressure and diabetes are two important risk factors for stroke that can be managed by medication, decreasing a person's risk, said study author George Howard, DPH of the University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Public Health. Our findings show that their association with stroke risk may be substantially less at older ages, yet other risk factors do not change with age. These differences in risk factors imply that determining whether a person is at high risk for stroke may differ depending on their age. The study involved 28,235 people who had never had a stroke. Of this group, 41% were black and 59% were white. Participants were followed for an average of 11 years. At the start of the study, participants were interviewed and given physical exams to assess risk factors. Risk factors included high blood pressure, diabetes, smoking, atrial fibrillation, heart disease, and left ventricular hypertrophy, which is the thickening of the heart's left ventricle. Because of the well-known higher stroke risk in black people, race was also considered as part of the assessed risk factors, Howard added. Researchers followed up with participants every 6 months, confirming strokes by reviewing medical records. During the study, there were 1,405 strokes over 276,074 person years. Person years represent both the number of people in the study and the amount of time each person spends in the study. Participants were divided into three age groups, which were then compared. The age ranges for those groups varied slightly depending on the data being analyzed by researchers. In general, the younger group included participants ages 45 to 69. The middle group included people in their late 60s to 70s, and the older group included people 74 and older. Researchers found that people with diabetes in the younger age group were approximately twice as likely to have a stroke as people of similar age who did not have diabetes, while people with diabetes in the older age group had an approximately 30% higher risk of having a stroke than people of similar older age who did not have diabetes. Researchers also found that people with high blood pressure in the younger age group had an 80% higher risk of having stroke than people of similar age without high blood pressure, while that risk went down to 50% for people with high blood pressure in the older age group compared to people of similar age without high blood pressure. In addition, when researchers examined race as a risk factor, they found a higher stroke risk for black participants in the younger age group compared to white participants in that group. The race difference decreased in the older age group. For stroke risk factors such as smoking, atrial fibrillation, and left ventricular hypertrophy, researchers did not find an age-related change in risk. It is important to note that our results do not suggest that treatment of high blood pressure and diabetes becomes unimportant in older age, said Howard. Such treatments are still very important for a person's health, but it also may be wise for doctors to focus on managing risk factors such as atrial fibrillation, smoking, and left ventricular hypertrophy as people age. Howard also noted that even where the impact of risk factors decreases with age, the total number of people with strokes at older ages may still be larger since overall risk of stroke increases with age. For example, in the younger age group for high blood pressure, researchers estimated that about 2% of people with normal blood pressure had a stroke, compared to 3.6% of people with high blood pressure. In the older age group, about 6.2% of people with normal blood pressure had a stroke compared to 9.3% of people with high blood pressure. A limitation of the research was that participants' risk factors were assessed only once at the start of the study, and it's possible they may have changed over time. The study was supported by the National Institutes of Health, including the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke and the National Institute on Aging. A common diabetes drug has a surprising side gig, muscle protector. Source, University of Utah Health. You might not think of diabetes when you think of muscle function, but a common diabetes drug that regulates blood sugar can also prevent muscle atrophy and muscular fibrosis, which can help the elderly bounce back faster from injury or illness. The University of Utah Health researchers have discovered that metformin, a common drug that's been used in diabetes treatment for more than half a century, has surprising applications on a cellular level. It can target zombie-like cells called senescent cells, which impact muscle function. Senescent cells secrete factors associated with inflammation that may underlie fibrotic tissue, a hardening or scarring of tissues. Metformin also reduces muscle atrophy. Their findings, published in Aging Cell. We're interested in clinical application of this research, says Micah Drummond, PhD, senior author of the study, and professor of physical therapy and athletic training at the College of Health. For example, knee surgeries in the elderly are notoriously hard to recover from. If we give a metformin-type agent during the recovery period, could we help the muscles get back to normal faster? Reinvigorating muscle recovery. As adults age, they're more likely to fall, be hospitalized, or develop chronic disease, and muscle disuse increases these risks. The research team wanted to find a therapeutic solution that could properly target both disuse atrophy and muscle recovery. There's an optimal level of senescent cells that are beneficial no matter your age. In younger, healthier people, short-term senescence is required for a proper recovery from injury, and completely blocking the senescent effect impedes the body's efforts to heal. Typically, a younger person can bounce back more easily after muscle disuse without the use of an intervention such as metformin. In the case of aging, we know that there's immune dysfunction, says Drummond. As you get older, it becomes harder for your body to clear senescent cells and they accumulate. That's one reason recovery is much slower for the elderly after periods of disuse. Metformin's anti-senescent properties have been demonstrated through preclinical studies. To test the intervention in humans, the team recruited 20 healthy male and female older adults for a multi-week study. They had participants undergo a muscle biopsy and MRI before the intervention, which involved 5 days of bed rest. One group of 10 received metformin, and the other 10 received placebo pills during a 2-week run-in period. Then each group continued the placebo or metformin treatment during bed rest. After the bed rest, participants received another muscle biopsy and MRI, then ceased treatments. All patients completed a 7-day reambulation period followed by a final muscle biopsy. We saw two things in our study, Drummond says. When participants took metformin during a bed rest, they had less muscle atrophy. During the recovery period, their muscles also had less fibrosis or excessive collagen. That buildup can make it harder for the muscle to properly function. Tying these results to senescence, the research team examined muscle biopsies from study participants. They found the participants who took metformin had fewer markers of cellular senescence. This is the first paper that has made the direct connection between a therapy targeting cellular senescence and improved muscle recovery following disuse in aging, says lead author Jonathan Petrocelli, Ph.D. He explains that metformin helps muscle cells better remodel and repair tissue during periods of recovery after inactivity. Our real goal is to have patients maintain their muscle mass and function as they age, because atrophy and weakness are some of the strongest predictors of disease development and death, he says. Drummond's team is following up on these findings by combining the drug with leucine, an amino acid that promotes growth and could accelerate recovery even further. They've already demonstrated the potency of this combination in preclinical animal studies. Metformin is cheap, effective, and quite safe, so it's exciting to see that we can use it to accelerate recovery for older individuals, adds Drummond. Type 2 diabetes alters the behavior of discs in the vertebral column. Source, University of California, San Diego. Type 2 diabetes alters the behavior of discs in the vertebral column, making them stiffer, and also causes the discs to change shape earlier than normal. As a result, the disc's ability to withstand pressure is compromised. This is one of the findings of a new study in rodents from a team of engineers and physicians from the University of California, San Diego, UC Davis, UCSF, and the University of Utah. Low back pain is a major cause of disability, often associated with intervertebral disc degeneration. People with type 2 diabetes face a higher risk of low back pain and disc-related issues. Yet the precise mechanisms of disc degeneration remain unclear. Investigating the biomechanical properties of the intervertebral disc is crucial for understanding the disease and developing effective strategies for managing low back pain. The research team was co-led by Claire Acevedo, a faculty member in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at the University of California, San Diego, and Aaron Fields, faculty in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at UC San Francisco. These findings provide novel insight into the potential mechanisms underlying diabetes-related disc tissue damage and may inform the development of preventative and therapeutic strategies for this debilitating condition, the researchers write. The study emphasizes that nanoscale deformation mechanisms of collagen fibrils accommodate compressive loading of the intervertebral disc. In the context of type 2 diabetes, these mechanisms are compromised, resulting in collagen embrittlement. These findings provide novel insight into the potential mechanisms underlying diabetes-related disc tissue damage and may inform the development of preventative and therapeutic strategies for this debilitating condition. Researchers employed synchrotron small angle X-ray scattering, SAXS, an experimental technique that looks at collagen fibril deformation and orientation at the nanoscale. They wanted to explore how alterations in collagen behavior contribute to changes in the disc's ability to withstand compression. They compared discs from healthy rats to those from rats with type 2 diabetes, UC Davis rat model. The healthy rats showed that collagen fibrils rotate and stretch when discs are compressed, allowing the disc to dissipate energy effectively. In diabetic rats, the way vertebral discs dissipate energy under compression is significantly impaired. Diabetes reduces the rotation and stretching of collagen fibrils, indicating a compromised ability to handle pressure, the researchers write. Further analysis showed that the discs from diabetic rats exhibited a stiffening of collagen fibrils with a higher concentration of non-enzymatic crosslinks. This increase in collagen crosslinking induced by hyperglycemia limited plastic deformations via fibrillar sliding. These findings highlight that fibril reorientation, straightening, stretching, and sliding are crucial mechanisms facilitating whole disc compression. Type 2 diabetes disrupts these efficient deformation mechanisms, leading to altered whole disc biomechanics and a more brittle, low-energy behavior. The team published their findings in the PNAS Nexus. Lockdown weight gain may have caused surge in new diabetes cases in kids. Source, Medical Express. Health Day. Rates and severity of type 2 diabetes among U.S. children rose during the COVID-19 pandemic, possibly due to weight gain during lockdowns, researchers say. While our study examined hospital admissions for type 2 diabetes in children at one center, the results may be a microcosm of what is happening at other children's hospitals across the country, said lead author Dr. Daniel Saya, an associate professor in the clinical trials unit at Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Stay-at-home orders increased risk factors for type 2 diabetes. They include less physical activity, more screen time, and other sedentary behaviors, sleep disturbances, and increased consumption of processed foods, all of which contribute to weight gain, according to the researchers. Even a slight weight gain over a short period can increase the risk of type 2 diabetes and heart disease. To learn more about type 2 diabetes in kids during the pandemic, the researchers compared the number and severity of hospitalizations for type 2 diabetes at Our Lady of the Lake Children's Hospital in Baton Rouge between March and December 2019, with the same period in 2020. The hospitalization rate for new-onset type 2 diabetes rose from 0.27%, 8 cases out of the 2,964 hospitalizations in 2019, compared to 0.62%, 17 out of 2,729, in 2020. Kids hospitalized in 2020 had more severe diabetes, with higher blood glucose, higher A1C, a marker of blood sugar over 3 months, and higher indicators of dehydration than those admitted in 2019, the study found. It also showed that in 2020, more kids had serious conditions that typically require admission to the intensive care unit, such as diabetic ketoacidosis, 8 children versus 3, and HHS, or hyperglycemic syndrome, 2 versus 0. Both conditions can lead to diabetic coma. Of 25 admissions in 2020, 23 were black children and 19 were boys, according to findings presented at a virtual meeting of the American Diabetes Association. Research presented at meetings is typically considered preliminary until published in a peer-reviewed journal. Unfortunately, COVID-19 disrupted our lives in more ways than we realize, Xia said in a meeting news release. Our study reinforces the importance of maintaining a healthy lifestyle for children, even under such difficult circumstances. Antacids may improve blood sugar control in people with diabetes. Source: The Endocrine Society. Antacids improved blood sugar control in people with diabetes, but had no effect on reducing the risk of diabetes in the general population, according to a new meta-analysis published in the Endocrine Society's Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Type 2 diabetes is a global public health concern affecting almost 10% of people worldwide. Doctors may prescribe diet and lifestyle changes, diabetes medications, or insulin to help people with diabetes better manage their blood sugar. But recent data points to common over-the-counter antacid medicines as another way to improve glucose levels. Our research demonstrated that prescribing antacids as an add-on to standard care was superior to standard therapy in decreasing hemoglobin A1C, HbA1c levels, and fasting blood sugar in people with diabetes, said study author Carol Chung-Hui Peng, MD of the University of Maryland Medical Center Midtown Campus in Baltimore, Maryland. For people without diabetes, taking antacids did not significantly alter their risk of developing the disease, said study author Wei K. Wang, MD of the Weilin Zuchi Hospital in Hualan, Taiwan. The researchers performed a meta-analysis on the effects of proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, a commonly used type of antacid medication, on blood sugar levels in people with diabetes and whether these medications could prevent the new onset of diabetes in the general population. The analysis included 7 studies, 342 participants for glycemic control, and 5 studies, 2,404,439 participants for risk of incident diabetes. The researchers found antacids can reduce HbA1c levels by 0.36% in people with diabetes and lower fasting blood sugar by 10 milligrams per deciliter, based on the results from 7 clinical trials. For those without diabetes, the results of the 5 studies showed that antacids had no effect on reducing the risk of developing diabetes. People with diabetes should be aware that these commonly used antacid medications may improve their blood sugar control, and providers could consider this glucose-lowering effect when prescribing these medications to their patients, said study author Kashif Munir, MD, Associate Professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Nutrition at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Boosting body heat production, a new approach for treating obesity. Source, Garvin Institute of Medical Research. A receptor that helps conserve energy when food is scarce may be the key to a safer approach to treating diet-induced obesity, research led by the Garvin Institute of Medical Research has revealed. In a study using experimental models and fat tissue biopsies from obese individuals, the team revealed that blocking a specific receptor of the molecule neuropeptide Y, NPY, which helps our body regulate its heat production, could increase fat metabolism and prevent weight gain. The Y1 receptor acts as a brake for heat generation in the body. In our study, we found that blocking this receptor in fat tissues transformed the energy-storing fat into energy-burning fat, which switched on heat production and reduced weight gain, says Dr. Yan Chuan Shi, leader of the neuroendocrinology group at Garvin and co-senior author of the paper published in Nature Communications. Most of the current medications used to treat obesity target the brain to suppress appetite and can have severe side effects that limit their use. Our study reveals an alternative approach that targets the fat tissues directly, which may potentially be a safer way to prevent and treat obesity. Y1 receptor linked to obesity. Obesity and overweight are major public health issues, which in Australia are estimated to affect 2/3 of all adults. The condition can lead to severe medical complications, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and some cancers. And while lifestyle changes are essential to weight loss, medication is a crucial adjunct treatment option for some. The authors of the study investigated Y1 receptor controlled by the molecule NPY, which is released in the body under conditions of starvation to help reduce energy expenditure and increase fat storage. Surprisingly, the team discovered that Y1 receptors were produced at higher levels in the fat tissue of obese individuals. The team then blocked the Y1 receptor using the experimental treatment B1B03304 in a mouse model of obesity. In our study, we found that mice were administered BIB03304 and fed a high-fat diet gained about 40% less body weight over 7 weeks than mice on a high-fat diet alone. This significant reduction of body weight gain was caused by an increase in body heat generation and reduction in fat mass, says Dr. Shi. Further, when we applied BIB03304 to human fat cells isolated from obese individuals, we found that the cells began switching on the same genes involved in producing heat as the ones in mice, which suggests that targeting the Y1 receptor pathway may similarly increase fat metabolism and reduce weight gain in humans, Dr. Shi adds. Targeting obesity at the source. NPY is a metabolism regulator that plays a critical role during states of low energy supply, where it helps store fat as a survival mechanism. Today, however, these advantageous effects can exacerbate existing diet-induced weight gain, leading to obesity and metabolic disease, says co-senior author Professor Herbert Herzog, head of the Eating Disorders Lab at Garvin. The researchers say a crucial component of the study was to demonstrate that the experimental treatment BIB03304 did not cross the blood-brain barrier, and that the anti-obesity effects of blocking the Y1 receptor pathways occurred not via the brain, but specifically only in peripheral tissues. Most current prescribed treatments are aimed at reducing food intake by targeting the central nervous system. However, these can have significant psychiatric or cardiovascular side effects, which have resulted in over 80% of these medications being withdrawn from the market, says Dr. Shi. Our study is crucial evidence that blocking Y1 receptors in peripheral tissues without affecting the central nervous system is effective at preventing obesity by increasing energy expenditure. It reveals a new therapeutic approach that is potentially safer than current medications that target appetite, says Professor Herzog. Our team and other groups have revealed further potential benefits in targeting the NPY-Y1 receptor system, including the stimulation of bone cell growth and improvement in cardiovascular function and insulin resistance, he adds. We hope that the publication of our findings will lead to increased interest for exploring BIB-03304 and related agents as potential treatments for obesity and other health conditions. Drinking a small amount of whey protein before meals has been shown to help people with type 2 diabetes control their blood sugars. In a study which holds potential for dietary management of the condition, people with type 2 diabetes drank a pre-made shot before meals which contained a low dose of whey protein. They were monitored for a week as they went about normal daily life. To compare the potential benefits of whey protein, the same participants also spent a week drinking a control shot that contained no protein in order to measure the results against each other. Results from continuous glucose monitoring revealed that glucose levels were much better controlled when taking the whey supplement before meals. On average, they had 2 hours extra per day of normal blood sugar levels compared to the no-protein week. In addition, their daily blood glucose levels were 0.6 millimoles per liter lower compared to when they consumed the supplement without any protein. Dr. Daniel West, senior lecturer and principal investigator working within the Human Nutrition Research Center and Diabetes Research Group at Newcastle University, UK, said, "While previous studies for a few hours in the lab have shown the potential for this dietary intervention, this is the first time that people have been monitored as they go about normal life. We believe the whey protein works in two ways. Firstly, by slowing down how quickly food passes through the digestive system, and secondly, by stimulating a number of important hormones that prevent the blood sugars climbing so high. As we see growing numbers of people around the world developing diabetes, investigating the potential of alternatives to drugs such as food supplements becomes more important." 18 people with type 2 diabetes consumed a small drink in a 100 milliliter shot with 15 grams of protein 10 minutes before breakfast, lunch, and dinner over 7 days and remained on their prescribed diabetes medication. Continuous glucose monitoring automatically tracked blood glucose levels over the course of the week. Newcastle University PhD student Kieran Smith, who oversaw the glucose monitoring and analyzed the data, said, "People were able to stick to the regime and liked the idea of having a convenient, tasty, small, pre-made drink that could be carried with them and taken before meals." The team intended to further explore the benefits of non-medical interventions, running the study on a larger scale and for a longer period of up to 6 months. They also plan to look at alternative proteins, such as those that come from plant sources, like peas, fungi, and potatoes, to open up options for vegan and religious dietary needs. This is Barbara Foster.